Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee the quality improvement program, run their meetings, develop educational programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 27 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for June 25th, 2018, recording from the Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies Annual Retreat in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, with interviews from the New York State Association meeting in Albany. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS. I'm here with Jenna Alvarez, also a Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, Alex Borneman, Director of Operations for Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, Judy D'Ambrosio, Director of Education, and John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and Eden Group Development, and one of the nation's leading ASC industry experts in regulatory compliance, finance, and administration. John is the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry and a frequent national speaker on all aspects of ambulatory surgery center management.
Welcome, everybody. Here we are in we're at the Split Rock Resort here in the Poconos, and we're here for our annual retreat. I guess we should point out that this is our first annual retreat.
First year.
We're having some fun. We actually just recorded next week's podcast, or part of next week's podcast, before we did this week's, so this is kind of a little weird right now. But so, how are you enjoying your time here?
Yeah, it's been great. Some of us went golfing.
How did that go?
I learned, this was my first time golfing, so I learned some of the things I shouldn't do. I learned how to hit the ball. That was the first challenge, is actually swinging and hitting the ball, and then moving it down the range rather than sideways.
Luckily were the only ones on the course.
Yes.
People were safe.
No people were injured. However, I think you had to stop the game at 9 holes because you ran out of balls.
Almost, yeah.
So if anybody needs golf ball, head for the...
So, Jenna, you've been absent from the podcast for a couple weeks here, so welcome back. Your husband, you just sent him off back home, so you just don't look terribly enthusiastic today.
A little tired.
Yeah, Jenna's been really our front person for some of our clients, and this is a well-deserved rest for her. So thank you for coming back. Judy, welcome back. It's been a while.
Yeah, a little while. Well, since... We did this together at the...
ASCA 2018.
That was fun.
Oh, that's right. We did a session over at New York State Association. I was trying to blend together.
So it's been a little while, but yeah, I'm happy. Plus, this is a beautiful place, you know, to do our first annual.
That's
Lake Harmony's gorgeous, you know, and we've been able to really enjoy each other, which is a really good thing.
Yeah, that's right. And I got to say that probably the biggest highlight is that I actually beat Alex in a board game yesterday.
In a board game. I know. Yeah. We need to write that on a calendar somewhere.
It is. It's amazing. And your husband was the other one that beat him. So
I found it funny. I was not involved in this particular bunch of games. I was down in our room not feeling well. And just like a 12-year-old, he came running back to that room. I won. Congratulations.
Now,
sweetheart, go away.
You beat everybody, right? Why is it you're singling out Alex? There were like seven of us playing.
That's true. That is true. And it was just you and me at the very end there.
Yes.
So
I was going to say, I was
a battle to the death, I heard. Yeah. Yes.
It was a good game, though. Well, because I won.
Well, yeah.
So we thought we would actually talk about something kind of weird here. You know, we're at this beautiful resort, and Alex, of course, the first thing he does is looks at the fire extinguishers, the fire safety system. And Alex, what was the last year that the fire safety system was checked?
2015.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
I was impressed by the fire doors, though. They are properly labeled, and I have a 1-hour fire rating on my door. So if I burn down my suite, you guys have 1 hour to get out.
That's right. Well, what I found interesting, though, we went to breakfast, and we were at this restaurant, and of course, you inevitably look around. It took us a while to get in there. It's very crowded in there. And the fire extinguisher on the wall right next to us was dated 2013. And then we looked at the exit sign, and the exit sign was off. And then we looked at the fact that the kitchen is right next to us. Yeah. And the exit sign was pointing to an exit where you could not get through, you know, to save your life, quite literally.
Well, they thought it was a great place to store things like vacuums and brooms. And I'm pretty athletic, so I could probably, you know, throw my whole body through all of that junk and maybe get out. I was pretty close to the exit, but I really would have rather be at the front exit there.
And I would burn. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it did bring up an interesting point, you know, about safety and the importance of, you know, having a culture of safety here. And that, of course, is the theme of this week's episode. So, you know, I was saying to myself, why does a restaurant like this, who has much higher risk of a fire, not get inspected regularly? Where surgery centers are inspected all the time for this. And by the way, this isn't just hypothetical. We were trying to find a restaurant to eat on our first night here, and it had just burnt to the ground.
The one we were interested in going to?
That we wanted to go to. Yeah. So clearly these are, you know, dangerous places, and they're not being inspected nearly as much. But let's just talk about that culture of safety, that whole concept here. I think if we do our job right when we're training people on the importance of fire safety, doing drills and things like that, not only, you know, are we going to make our centers safer, but, you know, obviously start making people think a little bit more about their own safety when they're in public places or they're at home. So who wants to start?
I can talk a little bit about that. And I think a lot of it comes down to try to get buy-in from your employees so that they feel a part of the safety culture and maybe have initiatives where, you know, there's reasons for them to be participating in perhaps looking for fire extinguishers that are out of date or things that are stored in the incorrect places so that your exit pathways are clear.
To be proactive instead of just, you know, waiting for somebody to find...
Right, rather than reactive. And this goes for, you know, fire safety, infection control, and all of the different items that we talk about, quality improvement in general.
Right. So, Judy, how do we do this? You know, how do we get people engaged in this? I mean, you and I are educators. We've spent quite a bit of our lives in the educational field in various ways. Myself, I've been in college, and, you know, I'm not sure we're doing a great job, you know, given the problems that we find with, you know, educating new employees, et cetera. So what are your thoughts,
sir? Well, Alex makes a good point in that you have to have buy-in. They have to want to be involved
in
this.
It's got to become personal.
So... the drills are great, especially the drills that Alex has developed since he's been with us and the interaction of the center's employees. You had told me a story, Alex, about an active shooter drill, and I apologize. I don't remember which center of ours it was, but I don't think it went incredibly well. but you said that there was such an interaction of how much people learned. Oh, wow, I didn't even think of that. Or, oh, wow, I could get out this way. And it created a discussion, and they became involved in the training. It wasn't you droning on about what they need to do and how often they need to do it and how they need to document it. And I think that, I mean, they kind of glaze over.
Right.
But if you involve them in an activity and what they say is just as important as what you're teaching them, then they feel more of a buy-in. Like Alex and I had a conversation, and I think it was while we were sitting in Albany at the state conference. It would be a fun idea to come up with like a scavenger hunt.
Yep.
To purposely label a fire extinguisher 2013 or purposely put things in the egress hallway and then offer a prize for who comes to you and finds what the problem is.
That's a great idea.
A stupid prize. I mean, it doesn't have to be like a pay increase or a bonus or, you know, or something crazy, but movie tickets or...
Well, let's face it, food is always a good incentive in most of our centers.
So then it becomes, wow, it's one, I think. I'm going to find this. I'm going to be the one. Yeah. And I bet you that one employee never forgets that.
That's right.
Ever. Yeah. You know, and it is. It's just making them wanna do it. And some of this stuff is dry.
Yeah.
You stand up in front and teach it and they don't really hear you. I'm sure they try to, but I don't think it's the same as involving them.
Uh-huh. Well, a couple of years ago, I've told the story, I think, on a previous podcast, but it bears doing again. I did a fire drill in one of our centers, and one of the young people said, you know, when I asked what she's going to do, you just walk them through the whole thing. What are you going to do? There's a fire right there. And she says, I'm going to throw a chair through the window and crawl out. And, you know, and we're trying to convince her that this whole every man for himself is probably not the appropriate thing. And we thought she was joking, but she wasn't. But it started a whole interesting conversation because, you know, people don't realize what a 1 hour firewall means, you know, that just closing the door is going to, you know, buy you that time. I mean, you just have to buy the time to get the fire department to get there and, you know, help you through the process. So having that conversation and asking people directly what they would do, I think is a good way of doing it. And Sue, Jenna, and I were involved in a mock code at one of our centers. We did talk about this in another episode where, you know, the doctors didn't want to be there. They didn't want to be participating in this whole thing. And yet Jenna's write-up was so good that they were actually interested and involved and active, and they, you know, they walked through that whole thing. So, Jen, talk a little bit about how you put that together and why you think it really works so well.
Well, I went through and I came up with a realistic scenario for what I thought would be a realistic scenario. I mean, codes don't normally happen right. that often in surgery centers, so Thank it's goodness. Not something that most people have ever actually dealt with if they have only ever worked in surgery centers.
Right.
And really went through the process of ACLS, because I think sometimes, you know, you get your ACLS training once every 2 years, but if you're not doing it on a regular basis, you're not actually going to remember the flow and the process.
Right.
And you have the cards there, but I mean, it's really important to really practice it so you know exactly how you are going to react, because in an actual code, you're in a high stress situation and you're not necessarily thinking clearest. So we went through, we had, I think, 5 different rhythm strips that I had found. And so we kind of said, okay, so this is the rhythm. What are you going to do? And who's going to do what? So, you know, someone was giving the epi, someone was doing compression, someone right. was maintaining the airways. The anesthesiologist was identifying the rhythm and leading the group. So after 2 minutes of CPR, we would give them the next rhythm and make sure they actually check for a pulse, make sure I got a little tricky and put a PEA in there.
Whatever that is.
For my medical people out there. You know, really got them. I think we led them through 5 different rhythms and the whole CPR cycle. And, you know, let's go into the transfer plan and how would you deal with the EMS when they right. got there? How do you get EMS there? What's your transfer plan? Which hospital are they supposed to go to? Who would you call to give report?
It was a great conversation. And the people that were participating really actually praised it afterwards. So, I mean, we took people that were not looking forward to doing this, just wanted to do it because it had to be done. Actually, didn't want to do it then, and turn them into people that really kind of understood why we were doing this.
The other thing, a couple of the active shooter drills that we've done, and you know the other drills, it's kind of good to have real life experiences because a lot of people think, oh, that'll never happen to us,
and let's hope it never does.
And let's right. hope it never does. But the world we live in today,
you never know.
And right. you know, so I come in with my personal stories of hospitals that I've worked in that have had to deal with active shooters, and
people start taking it a lot more seriously.
You really do start, oh, this could happen here, and what would I do? And I think it encourages them to actually think about it and participate more and really know what they would do in an emergency.
So it gets back to that whole theme of a culture of safety, meaning that your organization just always understands the importance of maintaining safety, that it becomes inbred. Into your corporate structure, into the employees' mannerisms and everything they do. So, you know, it's great that we have checklists that somebody fills out, but it's probably not a bad idea to have other people do those checklists every once in a while, go through the place and identify those things. Because we know that, you know, if we keep saying this, looking at the same every week, every month, we might be missing things that are, you know, just so obvious to us.
I think another important part of education is teaching people why you're doing things the way you're doing things. Because I don't think that... Like, for example, the fire door thing. I remember when I first learned that I was going to close the patient door when the fire, you know, and close them, leave them in their room when I worked in the hospital. I didn't realize, like, I didn't understand, but why are we closing the door?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why do we do that? And, you know, unless people know, oh, because those doors have a, you know, 1-hour fire safety rating, the safest place for them to be is behind that door. But if you don't teach people that, they're just doing it without knowing why they're doing it, and it doesn't really give them the motivation to, this is actually going to help save a life.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
You're right. We used to do that all the time in the hospital, and I took the longest time before I think any of us knew. We just knew we ran around and closed the doors. But
you ran around, you really closed didn't the doors, and you moved equipment out of the way, and you're like, well, okay, this is what I do, but like, why am I doing it? And I think sometimes it takes a while for people to actually learn that because they don't get told that. And it's kind of a silly thing if you think about it. Like,
but that's why these drills, this participatory, is that the right word? Participatory education seems to work so well because now they're in it and they understand it, you know, and you're right. God forbid they ever need it, but at least their mind will have that culture that I'm just as important in saving lives here as the EMTs that show up or the emergency personnel that show up. I'm as important to this process as anybody else, regardless of who you are, from the janitor to the medical director. All of you have a duty and a process, and you're important. I think that's how you get that buy-in.
Well, I think that, so segueing into the last thing we should talk about, and that is empowerment. You know, being, the, you know, there's this old story about, you know, if the co-pilot realizes that, you know, the flaps are up and they're trying to land, should he tell the pilot, even if the pilot's the guy in charge? You know, obviously you need to make sure that anybody feels comfortable in bringing something up that's going to, you know, be an unsafe situation. And that's very critical to us because we know that we have power differences between, you know, nursing staff and physicians and the owners, et cetera. And sometimes people don't feel, you know, safe in bringing these things up. You know, it's interesting. We talk about this quite a bit in our organization. We have very different organizations. We have organizations that, you know, their power structure is such that there's kind of a very good relationship between the employees and the administration. And then there's other organizations that feel that the best structure is by fear. And I think we all agree that that's probably not the best way. But I've even had conversations with organizations that do this, that obviously do this, and they say, no, this is a very, you know, conscious decision on our part because we feel it weeds out, you know, the weaker people. I don't agree with that, but we have to recognize that even among our organizations, sometimes we don't have the power to be able to change that, but we do have the responsibility to make sure that people feel empowered to step in when the danger gets to the point where you have to speak up, otherwise somebody's life is going to be, you know, at risk.
It's a really fine line, you know, for those centers that have employees that are there that are just, and I hate to say afraid, but reticent, let's say,
right,
to point out to an owner or a physician, God forbid.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to combat that.
But there's a lot of cases, you know, the Joan Rivers story where people didn't step up. You know, those are all situations where, you know, people really need to understand that your nursing license is on the line. You know, well, Jenna and Sue, you know, you don't want to take
that. There was that story a couple, I think it was about a month ago or so, about the dancing doctor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and, I saw that, yeah.
You know, you see the videos, and I mean, I know she's now, her
she's
license
been suspended.
Has been suspended. But as a nurse, I kind of look at that and I say, aren't those nurses just as responsible? I mean, to me, your job is to advocate for that patient. That's what was really like beat into me in nursing school. You are the patient's advocate.
Right.
And so to see them not only not stopping, and I don't know if they were nurses in the room. They might not have been.
We don't know the whole story. Yeah.
But to me, someone in that room should have said, no, you have contaminated your sterile field.
Right.
You need to stop. We need to, you know.
Well, what if you're really afraid? What if you really have the fear that if I speak up, I'm going to lose my job here. I need my job. I have kids in college, whatever. So you're actually afraid. How do we empower those people? How do we get them not to feel that way?
I think the administrators have to always.
But like John says, there's administrators that say, we like them when they're afraid. It's, you know. So what do you do?
Well, it comes down to corporate culture and recognizing that some jobs are just not worth, you know, sticking around if you know that you're going to lose your license.
And that's that exact. I mean, not only were those maybe nurses, I'm not sure, not saying anything, they were participating actively in something that could have been
endangering their license.
They did endanger the patients. They had bad outcomes. They had infections. And,
And we hear stories about this sometimes, or a nurse will speak up. And the doctor will shut her down, and, you know, and then they're afraid to speak up the next time. But if they do, maybe that next time they catch something, and then people are appreciative. But you have to have somebody, whether it's the administrator or the doctor, you know, just realizing they might be saving you.
Right.
You know, and sometimes
and
it's a mistake, but you have to be willing to speak up, or, you know, you might miss something really big.
That's another thing, like when we're doing our annual training, telling our staff about our quality improvement program and incident reporting and near miss reporting, like you need to empower them to speak up or to file incidents if they see something that is done wrong. Because if they don't, first of all, someone else could make that same mistake if it was a mistake. Or, you know, no one's going to know that there was a problem with another employee or that needs to be
rectified.
That whole, and that whole good catch as opposed to near miss, I think is so important, because it's more like, hey, you know, you might have stopped a problem, not like, oh, you almost made you know, made a big mistake. So it's just
our
changing that whole way of looking at it.
Our own terminology sometimes gets to us.
And welcoming that. Welcoming that information.
Yeah, a lot of, especially I think the new centers, oh, no, we've never had an incident. Yeah. I'm like, okay, but you said right here that your machine broke down.
Yeah.
That's an incident. You had an equipment failure. You had to fix it.
Sometimes that can be a near miss, actually. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something you did. It doesn't mean anything bad about your organization. Everyone has equipment breakdown.
Right.
But your equipment broke down. You had to deal with it. You had to figure out how you're going to do the cases without that equipment, or cancel the cases, or you know, find other supplies to use instead of that. And that's something that you can say, okay, did we do a good job? Is there something we could have done better?
Right.
Is there something that we should put into policy to work around? You know, that happens again, if there's something we should stock extra, what did you do? What can you do better?
It comes down to the idea that every mistake is a teaching opportunity. Yeah. Every mistake is a way to learn to do better. And it isn't something you need to hide. Oh my, you know, we didn't do anything wrong ever. We never, you know, you have to embrace those and say, and to accept that to err is human, and look how we're going to fix it so that we don't do this again, or at least help ourselves not to do that again.
Yeah, and be proud of your problem-solving ability that you were able to overcome that. And look at this as a challenge.
To be proud that you
found it. This is how I would deal with it, because something's always going to happen.
Otherwise, you don't have quality improvement program.
Yeah, you could be very well educated and very good at your job, but if you can't handle some kind of a mishap, then, you know, that's something you need to learn too. And
so that's a culture change. That's hard. How do you get them from being afraid to announce or to report that they've made a mistake, instead of, I'm so proud that I found this. You know, how do you make that cult? Because that would help a lot.
That's something that I think comes with experience.
Yeah.
You know, I tell the story.
I
made a medication error in my, you know, first, I think I made two medication errors in my first 6 months of being a nurse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had support from management, from my fellow nurses, and I felt terrible. I probably beat myself up more than, you know,
Jenna anyone. Beat herself up on it. Does anybody find that surprising?
My supervisor used to laugh because she never worried that I was doing anything wrong, because I would tell her if I did anything. You know, I was the first one to confess. And then, you know, beat myself up about it. And she's like, okay, but, you know, it's over with, nothing bad happened, and now you're never going to make that mistake again.
Right.
And I think it took me a while to realize, not only can I, you know, have I learned from those mistakes, but I can teach new nurses that are coming through my experience, and they'll never make my mistake either. And I think for a long time, I you live with shame that you made some sort of mistake. And luckily, my patient wasn't harmed by my mistake, but I felt terrible because I thought about what could have happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like you said, though, your nurse manager had so much trust in you because she was never worried that you were hiding something or trying to make too little of something that happened. You were, you know, very honest about it. So I'm sure that really built her trust in you, too.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the problem I think I see with quality improvement programs the most is that don't report back down to the employees that are reporting.
Make sure there's a good feedback mechanism.
Having that feedback mechanism. You know, if a mistake happens, you don't have to say who it happened to. But if you kind of say, okay, we recognized that this happened, it was because of our system of doing this, and this is what we're doing to fix it. Because I think sometimes what organizations end up doing is they put fixes in place, but they don't tell their employees what...
Nobody knows why.
Why.
Right, yeah.
What the reasoning behind it is. Yeah. And
so it just seems like another dictate that came from administration, something else that they have to do rather than solving
the problem. But I really do think that learning from mistakes is the best way to learn. And it gives me a reason behind everything that I'm doing, that, okay, I know that in this situation, I never am going to do this because this could happen. Mm-hmm. And I don't want that to happen to my patient. Because everyone wants to do what's best for their patient. And they might just not realize what they're doing is putting their patient in danger sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good way to end this segment. So let's take a short break, and we'll come back with an interview with Betsy McCoy and a discussion about ways that you can improve your patient safety. So at the New York State Association meeting in Albany in May, we had Betsy McCoy, who has a website called hospitalinfection.org. And Betsy really focuses on issues with regard to reducing hospital infections. And she developed a tool just before the conference, 10 ways basically to reduce infections in the ASC environment. So let's listen to this interview recorded about 4 or 5 weeks ago at the New York State Association meeting. This is John Gailey. I'm here at the New York State Association meeting in Albany, New York for our spring conference. And I have with me Betsy McCoy, who is the chairman of the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths. She's also the former Lieutenant Governor of New York State. Welcome, Betsy.
Thank you. It feels great to be back in Albany. I was traveling up here with a colleague today and giving him the grand tour from the Capitol up to the Desmond Hotel where we are right now.
Which I'm sure you spent a lot of time during your tenure at the state.
I literally lived here for 4 years.
Right, yeah. Right.
So it's good to be back. And it's especially a big opportunity to speak to your group because
sure.
The Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths has only one goal, to save lives.
Right.
And we do it by reducing infection risk.
Right.
I launched this national campaign 14 years ago, and we've made tremendous progress. 14 years ago, you didn't see those hand sanitizers everywhere in
right.
the hospitals, right? 14 years ago, Medicare actually paid hospitals to treat infections. Now, no more.
Right.
There's a huge financial incentive to prevent them. But it's a different world now because the majority of people who get surgeries don't go to hospitals.
Right.
So we have really shifted our focus to ambulatory surgery centers where 58% of surgery patients go. And we're telling the world that it's already a big advantage to have your surgery on an outpatient basis. The infection risk is lower. But we're eager, very eager, to work with the ambulatory surgery centers to reduce the risk even more.
Right.
And one of the reasons I'm here today is to urge ambulatory surgery centers to use their low infection risk, which is so well documented.
Right.
It's a JAMA 2014, more recently in the Journal of Bone Surgery, another important study on ankle surgery and the reduced risk when you do it outpatient at an ambulatory surgery center. So I've brought those articles, and what I'm saying is display in your waiting rooms, convey to your potential audience the importance of a lower infection risk, and then work with us to get it even lower.
Right, right. Well, and the title of your session, which will be in about an hour, is Infection-Free Environments, and We Are Safer Than Hospitals. Of course, being an old hospital guy myself who switched over, made the change, I love to hear us compared against hospitals. And you have the data, too.
I definitely have the data, all peer-reviewed data, which we should flaunt.
Right. Agreed.
Because patients are very concerned about infection risk. If you poll it, well over 90% of the public believes that nosocomial, that is healthcare infections, are a very important issue. And they are. Healthcare infections kill more people every year than AIDS and breast cancer combined. And it doesn't get the same kind of attention.
Right.
But as I said, we are so delighted to work with ambulatory surgery centers because they already offer a big advantage to patients, and we can increase that advantage.
So tell me how you have a website. We'll create a link.
www.hospitalinfection.org.
Okay.
We could call it healthcare infection, but everybody knows what it means. Right?
So we'll create a link so our listeners can see that. You have a lot of tools on that website, too.
We have a lot of tools. And today, we're unveiling 10 steps to minimize infection risk at ambulatory surgery centers. This particular pamphlet is directed not at the patients, but rather it's a tool for the ambulatory surgery centers, 10 steps they can take to reduce their risk even more. And we're hoping that surgery centers around New York State and the nation will want to become RID participants.
Okay.
Because that's a very important marketing tool.
Yeah.
If patients know that your surgery center is participating in this program, taking these 10 steps very seriously, they'll have more confidence.
Wonderful. So what are some of those 10 steps?
Okay.
I don't have to give them all here, but
well, why not?
sure, go for it.
We've got time. The first is every surgery center should designate one staff member as the professional where the buck stops.
Yeah.
I mean, preventing infection is everybody's job.
Right.
But one person should be accountable for measuring, reporting, and training staff. All incoming staff should really get a course in what to do to reduce infection risk.
So they're the advocate, basically, you're suggesting.
That's right.
And they may or may not be actually the chair of the committee or the...
Right. It's up to you which staff member is responsible. But if you have one person who is responsible, you'll make sure that everybody keeps their eyes on the ball, so to speak.
So we'll call that a champion, shall we say.
That's right. And then, secondly, rigorous cleaning. We know that environmental surfaces are the number one issue for infection control. It used to be that the emphasis was entirely on hand hygiene. But now we know that no matter how many times doctors and nurses and other caregivers clean their hands, the minute they reach up and pull open that privacy curtain, their hands are recontaminated. Yeah. And we'll get to those curtains in just a second, because they are the number one culprit. Number three is, I'm going to touch on something that might be a little touchy for some of the folks listening, and that is scrubs. Mm. Because in so many facilities, just like in hospitals, caregivers wear their scrubs home, throw them in the wash with the family laundry. Not good.
No.
The water isn't hot enough. They're exposing their own family members to bacteria carried home from a hospital or a surgical center. And it's also very bad PR.
Yeah.
It's very bad PR for the public to see your staff walking around in the parking lot, on a bus, wherever, wearing, in a deli, wearing those scrubs. So we strongly encourage surgery centers to use laundries, professional laundries that are certified as healthcare appropriate. They use hot water, they use the right detergents, and they get the job done. And that's very important for reducing the risk to patients, but also for selling your surgical center.
And we remind our listeners, too, that that is a standard in most of the accreditation, the accreditation organizations for ASCs. So I believe that most of our ASCs are certainly doing that right now, but it's great to hear
from you the importance of it. Right. Now, another one is headgear, because some surgeons like to wear those tie-back skull caps, but the fact is we know the bouffant shower cap style head cover is much better for preventing any scaling of the scalp or hair from falling into the perioperative area. So that's on the list as well. And ladies, we want to make sure that nobody's wearing jewelry, artificial fingernails, or nail extenders. These things are all pretty simple, but I was in a major academic hospital the other day in New York City in the emergency room, and one of the RNs had bangle bracelets from her wrist halfway up to her elbow. And I thought, oh, why isn't anyone telling her that, that there's so much bacteria hanging on those bangle bracelets?
Where have they been?
Right. Exactly. Where have they been? Exactly. Now, here's one where I think we can make great strides, and that is disposable paper privacy curtains or antimicrobial curtains, one or the other. Because as I mentioned very early on as we were chatting, these curtains become vectors for disease. They are, in many cases, the first thing doctors and nurses touch after cleaning their hands. Mm-hmm. And then they examine a patient, change a wound dressing, whatever, and then they reach up and pull that curtain closed again, right? Yeah. So this is a very simple thing to do. The paper curtains come with a Velcro strip that hangs right on the top of the permanent installation.
Okay.
And antimicrobial curtains are another option. But pay attention to the curtain, because that's a place that you can really eliminate bacteria.
This is interesting for me. I'm a surveyor with HHHC. So it's interesting. I've never heard of that before. Yeah. So definitely
when you go to the shows too, I'm on my way out to APIC in a couple of weeks, you'll see that there are so many options now to eliminate the problem of the curtain.
Okay.
In fact, I was at Stanford Hospital in Connecticut the other day, brand new hospital, which has been constructed to reduce the infection risk, very much on the top of the priority list. And they've eliminated curtains entirely.
Really?
Yep. Now, here's another one that I'm going to talk about later with our group, disposable ECG wires, because we have so many studies now that show that these are a contaminant, that they lay across the chest, often across an open wound.
And impossible to clean.
Impossible to clean. And these wireless ECGs are very good.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So a lot of companies make them now. I went to see LifeSync, but many companies make them. We never pick brands or advertise brands. Okay. Then here's one that where you can talk to your patients. So many people shave before they come in for surgery. Don't do that. Right. And now here's something where it requires a little delicacy. You need to talk with the surgeons using your surgery center about some of the clinical decisions they can make to reduce risk, like testing their patients for MRSA colonization ahead of time, right? And also controlling hypothermia, booties, and caps, and warmed IVs.
And that is one of the new Medicare quality measures, too, this year, is the normothermia.
That's right. And also of course, a prophylactic antibiotic before the first incision. So those are things we have on the reminder list at the bottom. Simple, right?
Absolutely.
10 steps. You can't argue with these.
Well, we'll post it and we'll make sure our listeners are well aware of it. Anything else you're going to talk about today during the session that you'd like to?
That's really it. I want to focus on cleaning and screening.
Yeah.
And the enormous advantage that ambulatory surgery centers offer patients.
Right.
And how to get out the word.
That's all good for the industry. That's what we're trying to get out to our public, get out to the policymakers.
Insurers,
that this is the place
too.
Again. Right. Thank you so much for your time, Betsy. I appreciate
you
coming here. Thanks.
One of the sponsors of the ASC podcast with John Gailey is Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. John, can you tell us about some of the services that AHS offers?
Sure. So we are a regulatory oversight organization. We basically are involved in the business of helping organizations to always be prepared for surveys and to respond to surveys and just to become your outsourced regulatory compliance organization. We also do financial oversight too, but the stuff that's probably most pertinent to most of our listeners relates to regulatory compliance and accreditation compliance. So our goal is always to have our organizations remain prepared for surveys. And so to that end, we maintain the policy manuals. We develop educational programs. We can even do the educational programs for the organization. We oversee the quality improvement program. We write the minutes for the quality improvement program, if that's what the organization wishes. And we help run the governing body meetings, again, if that's what the organization wants. And we'll write the governing body minutes for that. We also do periodic mock surveys. We help the organization through a survey, and we'll help them respond to the plan of correction necessary after a deemed status survey. And most importantly, this is all at a fixed price that might surprise most of our listeners.
Hey, so how do our listeners learn more?
So for a free, no-obligation consultation, give me a call at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And you can also visit our website at www.ah-strategies.com and fill out the contact us form.
Okay, thanks, John.
So let's talk about what's coming up with the ASC podcast with John Gailey. Each week, we discuss the latest news in the industry, discuss upcoming events, and review one or two areas of interest to ASC professionals. First of all, don't forget, if you are CAS certified, you can get one AEU for listening to episode 22, which was about pharmacy and appropriate candidates for surgery. All you have to do is sign up on the ASCpodcast.com website, pay the nominal fee for the credit, and you'll have one AEU credit for listening to that podcast. Next week's podcast, we're going to have another extended podcast on employee orientation, education, and in-services, and that will also will include one AEU credit in the area of human resources. Again, just go to the website to sign up to get that credit. And then July 9th, we'll be talking about public relations, working with the public, and dealing with difficult situations. All podcast content is subject to change if something important comes up that we have to address. So Sue and Judy, why don't you talk about upcoming events in the ASC industry?
Every week, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
We also have a calendar of events, so if you want to check that out, it's on our website at www.ascpodcast.com.
The Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Center Association Annual Conference is June 28th and 29th, 2018, at the JW Marriott Camelback Inn and Spa in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Registration for the online CAPE exam that will be administered during the month of October at various testing centers throughout the United States is August 1st through the 31st, 2018. To register, go to www.aboutcape.org. So that's www.aboutcape.org.
The California Ambulatory Surgery Association CASA Annual Conference is September 5th through 7th in Huntington Beach.
The Ohio State Association meeting will be September 18th through the 20th at the Hilton Polaris in Columbus, Ohio.
Pennsylvania Ambulatory Surgery Association annual meeting is October 1st, 2018 at Sheraton Harrisburg Hershey Hotel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
And by the way, we just found out that I'll be there, so we'll have our whole crew there. Hopefully we'll do a podcast from there also.
The 5th Annual New York Metro ASC Symposium, November 2nd, 2018. At the Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square.
And again, I'll be speaking at that conference too. And again, I don't know what's going on with the podcast, but please make sure you go and listen to me there.
The CASA Infection Prevention Seminar is November 7th and 8th, 2018 at Costa Mesa.
Registration for the CASC exam that will be administered during the month of October at various testing locations throughout the United States is August 1st through the 31st, 2018. To register, go to www.aboutcasc.org, www.aboutcasc.org.
If you would like your event listed on our website and discussed on air, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com.
So thank you for all of our guest hosts this week. It's been quite a crowd around the microphones here, and we've had a lot of fun. So we'll talk to you next week.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.